Welcome everybody to our vital Q&A call for December 4th. I'm sitting here looking at my calendar. What is today? 2018. And Dr. Rita Marie is in California attending a conference. And so hopefully it's warmer for her than it is for, at least for me. I don't know what it's like in BC today. But it's cold for BC. Yeah, I was in Washington State last month, and it was actually fairly pleasant. But last month was what was there too. I came home and the plane lands and it's snowing. I'm like, yep, welcome home. All right. So the way we run these calls is normally we listen to the question, or I will read the questions first from the Q&A. These are people who, such as Barbara, they're across the pond, and she's in the UK, and other people in other time zones, so they're not able to attend. And so we read their questions and answer them first. And then we'll go on to see if anybody raises their hands and wants to have their lines opened, and we'll look at the chat. So are you ready to go here, Steph?
I'm ready.
All right. So Barbara has two questions. The first one says, Barbara's in the ERC, and I really appreciate this. She put in her question. So if you have questions that you put either in the Q&A or if we open your line to talk and you're in one of our programs, please let us know that. That really helps us to better serve you. So Barbara is in the Energy Recharge Coaching Program. She said, is it best to peel organic turmeric and ginger before using them raw in a drink, or is it okay to use them with the peel?
Mm.
I will ask you first.
My answer is that depends. So the peel, a couple things happen with the peel. Like if you're juicing the turmeric or ginger, the peel adds a little bit of bitterness to it. The peel does have bacteria that are naturally on it. I feel like turmeric and ginger travel a long way and get touched by a lot of manky hands before I eat them, so I tend to peel them. I just get a baby spoon and I just scrapey, the peel off of the ginger or turmeric. If I'm making, sometimes I use it as a starter to make a fermented beverage, then I don't peel it. I just slice it up. We can talk about that another time. But so it really depends. I go with my gut feeling. There's nothing wrong with eating the peel, but for all the people that touched it, to me. What do you think, Lynn?
So I'm assuming you're talking like making a ginger bug or something.
Yeah.
When you're talking about fermenting it. Okay. Well, I'm lazy, and I might brush it off a little bit and then just go at it. And then also if I'm going to make the ginger tea, I also don't really bother too much with it. I also use ginger in especially this time of year, in my bath water. Again, don't peel it.
Nice.
Where I live, the chances of finding fresh turmeric are next to forget it. And so my experience with organic turmeric is very limited. It's usually when I only go to Dr. Rita Marie for a conference or something, and they get it because they live closer to Whole Foods. And and so I don't think I've ever seen her actually do that. I'm just looking at the chat to see if anybody else has anything else to say here about that. Dana just says specific botanicals of turmeric. And Lynn Rose says, yep, not me. You have to get it ordered at the right time. So, okay, I see what she's saying. She actually orders it. I didn't realize you could actually order it. I am making note of that.
That's cool.
Yeah. And ginger. Oh, that's even better to know. And they're both organic. Cool.
Great.
So that's Pacific Botanicals that we can look up and see about ordering. So I hope that helps.
Great.
I don't know if you can get that in the UK there, Barbara, but all right. And Barbara's next question says, it is said that black pepper increases the uptake of turmeric, but I also heard that black pepper can cause kidney problems. Is that true? Mm. And does cayenne pepper have the same effect as black pepper? If not, is it okay to use black pepper regularly? So we got a culmination of questions there. And I know I've heard you speak before about black pepper and turmeric.
Yeah.
So.
So I just have a couple things about black pepper and turmeric. So it does, black pepper helps turmeric in two ways. One of the ways it does help it in liver, but the most important way that the black pepper helps the turmeric is it kind of causes leaky gut for a little while after eating it. You know, I'm talking for a matter of hours after you eat the black pepper. So whatever you eat with black pepper, the absorption is actually going to be increased. So be it turmeric or whatever you had in your meal, it has to be quite a bit of black pepper, but it does cause a bit of leaky gut. So depending on what's already going on in your gut and depending on what else you're adding to your turmeric elixir or drink or food, you may or may not want to increase the leakiness of the gut. You may not want to increase the absorption of everything. Sometimes this comes up when someone might have kind of an imbalance of bacteria and they're working on it and they want to use turmeric for all of its antioxidant and microbe modulating properties, and then they add the black pepper and sometimes they end up feeling worse. And so that can be why, unless they have an actual allergy to one of those things. Anything else you want to say, Lynn?
Well, and I know I've heard you talk, too, about the fact, you know, there's a whole nightshade discussion, and that kind of goes along with what you're talking about there.
Totally.
So it sounds
it's
like...
It's really cool to know. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, ahead. I was just going to say, I think this also leads to the discussion of making sure your digestion is good in the first place.
Totally.
You know,
like it's
because like
yeah,
you
it's
said, if it's already leaky.
Yeah. Yeah. Then we might not need to or want to add more black pepper. Exactly. Or if you're doing like a yeast detox and you're also doing like turmeric and black pepper, you can kind of exacerbate things a little bit. But yeah, so then let's like segue to the nightshades for a second, because now we're talking about like red peppers. So the way that nightshades irritate our gut is by they just kind of like cling on to the side. So they kind of just glom on and stick around for a couple days, and that's an irritation for anybody. But it just depends on how robust, you know, your mucosa is in your gut and how healthy the gut barrier is. As to how much, you know, that's going to bother you. And if you eat nightshades at every meal, it can kind of compound. You might want to just choose the one of those options that's the best for you, or go for something like rosemary or something that can help the turmeric in the liver, but isn't going to necessarily change what's going through the gut wall. Yeah.
And then Rose says fenugreek is sometimes used to assist.
Cool.
Yeah, so apparently Standard Process adds fenugreek seed to their turmeric instead of black pepper to increase the uptake.
Oh, wonderful.
I did not know that.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like fenugreek.
And I think you made I do too. I think you make a really good point, though, because sometimes you throw the baby out with the bathwater when it has a lot to do with how much you use. You know, less is more.
Yeah, threshold. Exactly. So instead of making, like a rule, like this thing is bad, it's more like, what's it doing in my gut? Have I reached my threshold? How am I feeling today? those kind of things. And black pepper has myriad benefits too. It's been shown to decrease inflammation and so many things. So there's no, yeah, there's pros and cons for everything. It's choosing what's right for you.
Yeah. Right. I mean, because it can be anti-inflammatory, antioxidants, all that other good stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, just pay attention. Do a lot of that, that listen to your gut. You know, too often times we eat something and we're like, oh, doctor or Mr. or Mrs. expert over here said that this is good for people, and so I better do it, when in reality, you are your own best expert. So,
yeah, exactly.
All right, so those are the only questions that were written ahead of time, and I'm just going to check real quickly to see if there's anything else here. I know we were talking about the weather. Oh, Dan. So I know Diane lives in Idaho, up in the mountains, and so she's experimenting with hoop house gardening over the winter time. And somebody had brought her some old Christmas lights, and so her plants have been surviving because of the Christmas lights and maybe the festive appearance. Let's see.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. So we put the web address for the Pacific Botanicals in the chat. And that's it from there on the chat. So I have a hand raised cell phone in Toronto, Ontario. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, who is this?
It's Mary. How are you? Mary.
Oh, well, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Great.
So, you guys are answering questions today. I think is Dr. Marita away this month?
Yes. Yep, she's in, well, this week she's in California.
Oh, nice.
So we have me and then Steph Jackson.
Okay. So can I ask a question with respect to butter?
With respect to who?
To blood work.
Oh, you can try. I mean, you can ask. We can try.
Okay, all right. I just did some blood work last week, and I just concerned about a couple of numbers. And, of course, I went into Dr. Rubina's extensive chart that it kind of explains why numbers are high and low and so forth and so on. So I'm just trying to just not get too worried, but so just a couple of things. My hold on a second. Of course, the phone rings when I'm on. My RBC and hemoglobin and hematocrit is a little low. Mm-hmm. I was a little concerned with that only because when I read her stuff, it said it could be a few things, and then one of it was like internal bleeding, and I'm like, oh my God. So I was a little concerned with that. And then the other one that I'm kind of, my creatine is low as well. And then the other thing which is high is my AAT, I guess, alanine aminotransferase, which is significantly high. It should be less than 36. I'm Canadian, so I'm going by Canadian, I guess, units that
well,
they use.
Well, that's in Canada. That's in Canada.
Oh, good, good, good. All right, so it should be less than 36, and I'm at 39. So, and then my GGT has been low as well, on and off. Although low, they say don't worry too much about it. It's the high that we have to worry about, so I'm fine with that. And then, of course, my thyroid's been swinging. I've had hyperthyroid issues, which is, you know, you don't get a lot of information on hyper. A lot of information is on hypo. And so my TSH has always kind of been wonky, and my T4 and T3 have been too, but my T4 and T3 are in line this time, so they're in range, but my TSH is now low, whereas the last couple of months I've had my TSH actually finally in range, and now I was concerned. Right. I was concerned that it was coming down slowly. So I'm not sure if this is all a product of the accident that I got into. I was in a car accident, and my body's been kind of stressed and so forth and so on. And it's still kind of going, trying to figure itself out, or I'm not sure.
Right.
So I don't know. Is there any?
It's been about a year, right, since your accident?
No, my accident was July.
It was just, oh, for some reason I was thinking it was.
Oh, it just happened in the summer.
Okay.
July.
Yeah, so can we get specific for one sec? So yeah. TSH is normal. Like, what is your TSH?
So my TSH is low. It's not normal.
Okay,
okay.
But what?
So it's low. How low? What? Yeah.
What well, is the range? The range is 0.32 to 4, and mine is at 0.02.
Oh.
Okay.
So now it really significantly dropped. Like last month in October, because I've been doing my blood tests regularly, mm-hmm. it was at 0.5 something. So it was. Mm-hmm. It was in range still, but it was dropping. And I finally got it up to 1 point something at some point.
Right.
And now it's significantly dropped again. So I'm a little worried.
And you're
worried
not on
about...
thyroid?
No,
you're
I'm not.
You're not on thyroid medication?
No, yeah. No. But my T4 and T3. See, my T4 wasn't converting to my T3 too much. Mm-hmm. So I was having my T3 was the last thing that kind of sort of wasn't going into range. And now that's in range, even though it's kind of in that low end of the mm-hmm. range of between 2.6,
okay.
It should be between, it's at 2.8 right now. And then my okay. T4 is 12, which the range is 9
okay.
to 19. So.
So, yeah, how are you feeling in general?
Well, you know what? I know that I have
give
to
give me some adjectives here because I don't want to.
I know that my GI is off for sure. I've just had some issues with GI stuff. So I'm trying to look into all that.
Like,
I
how's
do have
your energy?
You know, energy-wise, I'm fine. Like, I don't have any issues with energy, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah,
I know. My iron, like, it could be iron that's low. It's, you know, anemic,
yeah,
whatever.
Did they test any of those other markers? Did they test
like the
iron binding capacity? Or?
No.
Yeah, I guess the ferritin, but the other things too.
No.
I mean, it might be worth going back in there and just asking them for that. I know that, like, here in BC, I have to sort of fight tooth and nail to get
of
these little, but the iron binding capacity and
mm-hmm.
also, like, I don't know if we have time on this call, but to look at the other red blood cell markers, like the RDW.
RDW is 13.5. That's in range, 13.5.
One of the questions I had is, were you well hydrated when you had
mm-hmm.
your test?
Probably not, because I do it usually in the, no, probably not, because I did it in the morning, and it was about 11:30 by the time I actually did it, and I probably didn't drink too much, and I had to actually, it's funny you asked that, because the last couple of weeks, I bought this restructured water thing, and because it's winter here, I typically drink my water warm in the morning. And because with the restructured water, I'm not supposed to boil my water once I've structured it. So I haven't been able to drink warm water in the morning. And so I haven't actually drank a lot of water the last week or two. But yeah, I could be dehydrated. But how is that, why did you ask that question?
Especially with, go ahead.
No, you go. You go.
Oh, no, I was just going to just it kind of pump things up. That's the only thing that's coming to my brain. I know that sounds so scientific, but
mm-hmm.
For some reason I have just this feeling of, and I'm just going by my intuitive feeling right now, because mm-hmm. I am not as familiar with your Canadian numbers, just what you're saying.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But starting right away with your RBC being low, I was thinking that it for some reason sticky came to my mind. So
what came to
your
mind first?
Sticky. And sticky. Yeah. Now, when I look at the health tracker, one of the things it talks about here too, under your red blood cell count, is because I know you were saying, you know, with the internal bleeding, but you know, to make sure that you're hydrated. So
yeah,
that was part of it. Also, you know, your ALT, your ALT, your AST, your GGT. Be more with your liver and electrolytes. And so,
well, I'm wondering if my liver thing has, because you know what, I've been doing this, I've been testing the whole keto, vegan keto thing. And I find that when I really remove a lot of like sugars and fruits and whatnot, that I tend to go more high fat. And I sometimes I think I probably go too nuts on those nuts and seeds. And so that could spike it. Now, the other thing, I think my AAT might be high as well. I'm just wondering if you know anything about that. So I did a 5-day fast. I didn't break the fast as well as I like to. I started to, but then by the evening I bonked by day 6. So I made it to day 5. I was fine, although I was having some of those aches and pains that people were talking about. And this is my first 5-day fast. And so on the 6th day, I did well throughout the morning, afternoon, and by the evening, I bonked. I ended up eating, what did I eat? I ate these, they were keto, nut bombs or whatever you call them, fat bombs, I suppose.
Fat bombs, yeah.
Yeah, but they had, I realized after they had, I thought they just had stevia, but then I read it and they had the uro, what are they called, the alcohol sugars? I forget what they're called.
Xylitol, or erythritol.
That's the one.
Yeah.
So, and maybe I had one too many of those. And I don't know if my sugar is kind of just reacting from all that stress. I'm not sure.
Well, was this blood test like right after that fast?
No. Yeah, no. When did I do the fast? I fasted probably near the end of October, maybe the second last week of October, or around mid-October, and my tests were just last week.
Okay.
Well, no, I don't want to...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, one of the things, too, to consider is that, especially if this is the first time you've ever done a fast, and it was a water fast, I'm assuming?
Yes.
This can put a stress on your body,
yeah,
and so your body can react in certain ways that reflect that stress. And so what I usually suggest to people if they're going to do a fast, a water fast, is to start out like with 1 day and see how you do.
Well, I've done multiple 1-day fasts.
Okay,
I've done
great.
No, it's not like I'm new to fasting in general. So I've done, 24, 36-hour water fasts before. I've actually done dry fasts. Okay. I've actually enjoyed dry fasting better than water fasting, believe it or not. But, so this is something kind of just sort of wanted to kind of try and see if I could make it through and whatever. So, and so I did make it through.
And making sure you were drinking enough water.
Yes. Yeah. Which I think I was.
So yeah.
For the most part.
Okay. All right. And then the other part to that too is making sure, I don't know the volume that you were urinating and the color and everything. That will tell a little bit of the story as well. Because the whole point of doing a water fast is to help your body to first relieve some of the toxins and kind of reset things. So if you're not urinating and releasing enough, and then, but also making sure you're absorbing it. So I like to encourage people to use the homeopathic drops called Rehydration by Energetics or something similar to that. And then also, things like skin brushing, maybe an enema, or a colonic, or you know, just things to help your body move. And that's part of the other question is, are you moving at all, whether it be like walking or rebounding or something like that?
Well, I just started rebounding again the last month because I was in a cast since July and August, so I couldn't do any. I was non-weight bearing for about 8 weeks or so, from a ankle fracture. So I've just started back on my rebounder again and doing some walking. So that was stagnant for a little while, for at least 2 months, for sure. I mean, I was moving, but I was moving on in one leg. So, but I wasn't exercising like my normal active self.
Right.
For sure.
Right. Yeah. And so those are all the pieces in terms of the water fast that you want to consider. And then you probably said this. What was the time between the water fast and when you did these tests?
About a month.
Yeah. Six weeks, maybe.
As far as any, and you did this in November, these tests?
Just last week,
okay. So, as far as any type of action plan or whatever, you know, that would be my first thing, is to make sure you do stay hydrated.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm just looking here. That's what I was looking at. Really make sure you stay hydrated. Work. You've got access to your, when you were in ERC, mm-hmm. you've got access to some of those.
The hydration schedule?
You've got the hydration schedule, but also the things having your liver. And.
Okay. You got cut off.
Right? The liver. You have things having to do with the liver and the liver herb. Make some different elixirs and things to help with that.
Right. Do you know what module the liver information is in?
Well, they switched things since you were in, so I don't. It's in the digestive.
Digestive stuff. Okay, that's fine. Yeah. That's all I need to know.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah. And there's also the bowel boot camp might also be some good things.
The bowel boot camp. Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Sorry, I don't know why you're just cutting it out suddenly. So I'm having trouble just. You start talking and your words get cut off.
Okay.
So my apologies for asking to repeat.
No, that's okay.
I just laugh when I hear bowel boot camp three times.
Third time's a charm.
Third time makes it funny, yeah. You gotta commit.
That's funny. Okay.
So what do you suggest here?
I feel like those are all fantastic suggestions that I would do. And the other thing that I would do is just Canadian style, go back to my doctor and see what else they can give me in terms of an iron panel, iron binding capacity, like do the ferritin again, do these again, and just see what else they can give you. You'll know, like you'll go in really hydrated and take another test, and then if it's still low, then we know we've kind of eliminated that variable a little bit. Yeah.
Right.
And then also, have you ever done a methylmalonic acid test?
No, I haven't been.
Okay, so the website is B12.com.
Uh-huh. You're talking about a B12 test? Yeah, I've done B12 tests before.
But methylmalonic acid is different. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah
I didn't know if it was methylmalonic. I'd have to check.
Yeah. Okay. So the website is B12.com, and they do specifically methylmalonic acid testing.
B12. Can we do it in Canada?
You can't get it on your regular lab, but what you can get is homocysteine. And so if your homocysteine is climbing up, if it's a bit on the high side, that's a good sign that your B12 metabolism might be a bit low, or you might not be having enough B12 in your diet. So that's what I would do too. I would push to get a homocysteine added to it. You can explain to them why. You know, some of them just go for it, and some of them, you know, you have to like kind of work it a bit. But if you have a good doctor, they should be able to add that. You can explain that it's a functional marker for B12.
Right. Yeah, she gives me a hard time sometimes.
Tell her you're vegan. And you,
I know.
Like,
I mean, I've done B12 tests.
Yeah,
I know. I've done B12 tests before, and they have shown low in the past. And so I've always been sort of conscientious about that. And so I finally do have whatever B12 test. I'd have to look back in my blood work to see. But I did get one done, and the B12 has been in range. At some point I had very high B12, and I think it was because I was supplementing. So.
But yeah, so the B12 in your serum is like less than 2% of the B12, and like we really want to know functionally whether your body can use that form of B12, whether it's just floating around or what's going on in there, whether you can use it to make blood cells and the whole bit. So hopefully they'll give you that test.
So you can't get that other one? You can't get that other one in Canada?
Well, I just
you can get it. You just have to pay for it.
Yeah.
Oh,
the methylmalonic acid.
The methylmalonic, yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah,
Worth it. But you can't get it, like, at the regular, like, you have to order a kit, which is fine.
I just looked up the blood test here. Is it the Norman Clinical Laboratory?
Yep, exactly.
Is that what you're talking about? Oh, okay, no problem. I'll bookmark that and look into it. Read about it more. Perfect. Okay, sounds great.
Awesome. And then, yeah, when you do all those other things, then you know to make sure your digestion is good, because making sure you're actually absorbing the nutrients from your food, the things to make sure your stomach acid is at a good enough, eating iron-rich foods. You know, and you get all your degrees in there. Yep, exactly. So.
Right. Okay, perfect. Great.
All right,
great. Thanks,
Amy. Great to be on next week or next month, so you can, we'll find out how well.
Yeah, I'll probably have more information as well for next month, hopefully, anyhow.
Okay.
I have some other detailed blood work that has to get done by the end of the month, but I got to be on my cycle to do the blood work.
That was one of my questions.
That was a question.
Sorry.
Yeah.
No. So I wasn't on my cycle. That's the other question. Yeah, I was not on my
cycle. But you are still cycling at all.
Yes. But when I did my test last week, I was not on my cycle, which is why I was concerned with RBC. But the next batch of blood tests, and my naturopath has actually requested much more. She actually wrote to my doctor herself to get further testing done. And I have to be on day 19 through to 22 to do these blood work. Mm. So I'm just waiting for that.
Okay.
Excellent.
All right.
All righty. Perfect. Great.
Well,
thanks, Amy.
You're welcome. And if we don't talk to you before, have Merry Christmas, great holidays.
Oh, right. This is the last call before next. Right. Okay. I don't know if there's another call this month at all, but. Is this the last call for the month?
For the vital. Well, there's a vital health topic next week, and then, of course, the vital healing kitchen show. But next week is the last week of calls, and then. So she takes the last couple of weeks of the month to kind of recalibrate and she works, believe me. But I mean, just having that flow of time to see where she's at and having a little more downtime, because her boys will be home, and So,
right, of course.
Okay. Yeah.
Perfect. All right, great. Thank you so much, ladies. Appreciate it. Yes.
You're welcome. Take care.
Okay, have a good holiday. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Okay, now we have Debbie. Hey, Debbie, how are you doing?
Good. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, you can? Okay, I wasn't sure how this is going to work. I'm so used to the Zoom now, I didn't know where the microphone would be coming. I guess it's just in my computer. So, yeah, I'm doing okay. I have these appointments every Tuesday, and so I can't make the calls when they're usually they're like in the 4 o'clock range, and I'm not home yet. So I was really happy that this one was at 5 o'clock and I could join you guys.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you.
Yeah, and you guys might have seen that interconnected series that I think I heard about it through Dr. Rita Marie about the microbiome that's playing right now.
Yeah, I haven't had a spare moment.
I haven't actually watched it. I mean, I've seen the emails come through, and I know that Pedram is you know, he's somebody I pay attention to, but I just.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's so good, but it's probably not new for you guys with your background, but it's certainly really good information, and it's got, you know, having me think about the things that I've been working on. They talk, of course, it's about the microbiome, and I'm pretty sure I have SIBO or some kind of conditions where when I take probiotics, I generally get a lot of stomach pain from the lactic type. And then also when I eat microbial fermented foods, I have terrible histamine reactions, like very severe histamine reactions.
Mm.
So I don't do any kind of probiotics or fermented foods. And I'm wondering if I did hear that bifido is one that could be tolerated if you have SIBO or others. But it's like I don't even know if I should venture out, if I should just try to work on balancing my microbiome without doing those, or if those kinds of foods, or if I need to do either, you know, bifido, some type of probiotic or food to balance, or just start with some kind of dietary approach first.
Right. Okay, so the two things that you mentioned were a histamine reaction and gut pain, which are and can be totally unrelated. So a person can be having histamine overload without having any kind of SIBO at all, or a person can be having like a bacterial imbalance and not be getting a histamine reaction. So do you feel like you're having both of those issues?
Yeah, I'm having both. I have, you know, when I did the testing last year, I do know that I have a lot of fungal overgrowth.
Mm-hmm.
I had a
bit. Germ is going.
And then I have parasites and I have bacterial overgrowth, but I haven't.
Yeah.
Because my sense system is so sensitive, and I've been underweight, I haven't really tried to go add any of those yet. I'm just trying to figure out if there's maybe a real gentle dietary approach I can use first, or if maybe you have to go out after these things before, you know, to get things balanced enough. I'm feeling a little bit confused about it.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. People are throwing the word balance around a lot, and I feel like there's good information on that summit, but I feel like there's information overload. A lot of people have quit taking their probiotics, and they're like, I need balance. The issue is with probiotics, like I'm not going to sugarcoat this for you. You cannot get balance by taking probiotics. You cannot, because there are thousands and thousands of species in our gut. There's less than 100 species you can buy in a capsule or pill. And most of those are those lactic acid, the D-lactic acid producing bacteria that are going to contribute to issues in the small intestine.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, yeah, it's not like you can buy a probiotic to help you maintain balance. Bifido, the reason why I gravitate toward the bifido is because they do want to live in the large intestine. So if you can continue to alkalinize the small intestine, and find a way to get bifido into your large intestine. And I'm sorry, but your large intestine is accessible from other ways other than through your mouth. So if you can balance the large intestine for what it's worth, and kind of reshape the environment of the small intestine. So if there are D-lactic acid producing bacteria in there, they can acidify it too much, and then you get more bacteria and they just camp out there and can grow, they can overgrow. It's just because they're in the wrong place. They think it's the large intestine because of the environment. So you can kind of change the environment in the small intestine and then change the environment in the large intestine through bifidobacteria. That's a start. But yeah, with the histamine, the biggest histamine producers are yeast and fungi in the body. And so I would, in this situation, I might actually tackle that first, the yeast. And I don't usually do that, but I feel like it's symptomatic for you, and you did mention it. So I feel like it's top of mind, which I think is important. So yeah, I think I would do that while changing the environment. And I know that's, I mean, it's hard to just do, but do you have any questions about that? Is that making sense?
Yeah. I mean, I have so many yeast fungal symptoms, skin-wise and just all over. So that feels right to me. Would there be what kind of gentle approach do you, or products or foods or whatnot do you gravitate towards for yeast and fungal, you know, for...
So, I mean, I really love the natural, like I like to always go to a tincture or an herb if I can, but I do like, the capsules. There's something called SF, like S as in Sam, F as in fire, 722. Whoever named this, I don't know what's wrong with them. SF 722.
Oh, I remember that. It had to do with like their stock number or something. That's why they named it that.
I just want to go like poke someone in the eye because I have to say this on like webinars all the time and like no one knows what I'm talking about. But yeah, so it's a thorn research product.
Yeah.
So that's the strongest thing that I know for the fungi. Mm-hmm. So the thing with that is to just like take it super slow. And with any of these things, if you eat something and then get a digestive symptom, pain, gas, bloating, you know that you're feeding something. So unfortunately, and there might be a threshold. It might be like one cup of Brussels sprouts is okay, but three is too much. So unfortunately, there's no like hard and fast, like eat this, don't eat that thing. It's just if you notice something is causing those symptoms, it might be good to either dial it way back or put it on a no list or a maybe try in a month later kind of list for yourself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because I've been...
You want to not feed them.
Yeah, because some, you know, it is sometimes hard to figure out what to eat with, you know, the different symptoms that I get. So just kind of go by that then.
Totally. Mm-hmm. It's important to, because... Those FODMAP lists or those lists of, you know, foods not to eat for the fungi, there are different reasons why all those foods are on the list, and there are different things that are happening in each of our bodies. So those lists are a great starting point. But so if you're having histamine issues, you might need to avoid more of the mushrooms or herbal teas or things like that than another person. But for the FODMAPs, for the stuff that might feed the bacteria, it's really individual because every food has, like, all the range of carbohydrates in it. So just depends on what you can break down.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just trial and error on that one.
Yeah, trial and error and enzymes. Even if you feel like they're not doing anything, enzymes. Yeah.
Take enzymes.
And Debbie's in ERC. She has Lisa.
Oh, yeah?
So.
Oh, cool.
I think it's...
Yeah, she's in ERC.
I think if you share that with her, too, she'll be able to give you guidance with that as well.
Yeah, and when you mentioned bifido, that you don't have to do it orally, that's right. You can do it like a suppository, right?
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
Yes. I prefer the suppository to the enema, but I actually like both. I feel like they both are doing something completely different in there. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, if you don't want to have it go through the small intestine, or if you're having symptoms when you do that, then, yeah, you got to just try another way. Yeah.
Do you make your own suppository with that, or is there something that you buy that's mm-hmm. like a bifido suppository?
I make my own. I would make my own. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that might be a way to go. I forgot that there's other ways of doing it. So, okay. Oh, good. Thank you so much. I know this is like your area.
Yeah. I hope that was sort of helpful, at least.
Yeah.
The thing about the environment, I feel like I was really vague about the environment of the small intestine. Basically, those bugs like make lots of D-lactic acid, and they acidify it, and then it makes them really happy there. So if you can find a way to like neutralize the acid in your small intestine, they're not going to want to live there anymore, and they're going to have to move on. So, yeah.
Whatever
you can do.
Whatever neutralized, whatever would alkalize the body in general, or is there a way specific?
So that's different. So that's the post-digestive effect. So a lot of foods that alkalize the body in general are like after you digest them, they're nice and alkalizing for the blood. What we want to do in this case is alkalize the small intestine. So like on an empty stomach, drinking a big bucket of nettle tea or green juice or, I hate to say it, but alkaline water, or depends on your budget, baking soda. Like you got to just do what you got to do, right? I want to make it accessible for everybody. So it's like it's just about making it not a comfortable home for them, not necessarily about doing something that's, you know, good nutritional food for us, but it's just about changing the environment in there because it's still sort of outside of our body.
Okay, so nettle tea, I wrote some of these down, green, like green veggie juice.
Okay. Stuff that's really alkaline in nature,
mm-hmm.
not just alkalizing. Yeah.
That's so weird.
And then on an empty stomach, it just goes through. So you can get lots of coating, lots of coverage in there.
It's like, that's what I'm craving right now. It's so weird, but those are, what you mentioned, are kind of the things I'm craving. So maybe my body's telling me.
Because that stuff is good.
I'm like, why am I craving green juice when it's like winter and, you know, but I think something's, you know, wanting it. So, okay, that's really good to know.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And you know you have a lot of those food lists in your grand program.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Like the five.
Mm-hmm. Like the FODMAPs and stuff, you said?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, this is good. Actually, I've been feeling like it's time to look at ground again and just kind of get back to the basics. So, yeah, so good. Okay. Well, thank you guys so much for being here tonight.
Yes, awesome. Thanks for bringing a good question. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. Let's see. And now we have Sandy. Hi, Sandy. Are you there?
Hi. Hello.
Hi, hello.
Everybody. Can you hear me?
I can.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can. Hi, everybody. So, this is a question for Steph. Have you fermented cranberry relish before?
Yes, I did. I saw you in the chat, and yes, I did. I have done lots of trial and error also with it. So.
That's why I'm asking. So I would have to do trial and error. If you can give us Diana. Diana started this because she made a beautiful relish, cranberry relish, and she was asking about fermenting it. And you know, I don't eat fruit, and I haven't tried fermenting any of it yet. I thought, well, this would be the perfect. I was so excited you were going to be on, so I could ask you.
Yeah.
What are the tips? What kind of did you use Bifido?
What am I going to say? Yes. So my best results have actually been with Bifido, with the like syrups and relishes and chutneys type thing that I've made with fruit. And so I guess the thing to keep in mind with that is to do it for a short amount of time. It's like in a day, it's going to maybe be done. And then it, of course, has to be kind of kept in the fridge.
You mean fermenting it, like maybe fermenting it only 8 hours or 6 hours?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Maybe 8 hours. Taste it after 8 hours. Taste it again after 12 hours if you can, if it still doesn't feel done. I did mine, like the one that I liked, for about 24. And then I did one that was like way too crazy, which went for longer than that.
Okay.
What else? I get better results when I still add a bit of salt to it.
Okay.
So the thing with those fruits, this is really sad to say, but like a lot of the nuts that we get have been pasteurized, or like they've had yeast and bacteria killed on them in some way, or they were in a shell. But those, like they're cranberries and blackberries and things like that, there are yeasts that are on them. And if you're like me, like I don't want to cook it first. I just want to ferment it and then blend it up, or, you know, create my relish or chutney. So you're going to have the possibility of yeast taking over in there. So add enough of your starter, your bifidum, add a little bit of salt, like add enough that you're going to discourage those yeasts from proliferating in there. And that does help.
So I can do the bifido, the coconut bifido starter that we make.
Yeah, exactly.
Coconut starter. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I would just add twice as much to that as I would to like a yogurt, because the yogurt's just a bit more under control in terms of variables.
Okay. So maybe a half a cup. Half a cup.
Exactly, for the same for like a liter. Yeah.
For a quart. Okay, so.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, quart.
For a quart. And then some salt, the cranberries, and then at the end, add the stevia or the monk fruit, right? Or could I add some coconut? Could I add some coconut sugar to the whole batch? Because usually for yogurt, I still do that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
you could.
I could try that.
It depends on what you're adding in there. So when I did my cranberry one, the one that I was really happy with, I just added some orange zest, a bit of orange juice, the cranberries, cinnamon. Like I kept it really simple. I fermented it when they were roughly chopped, and then after it had like in water. So there's like a water base. I put the stuff all in there, and then I fermented it together, and then I just dumped out my extra water. And then blended it up. So the worst ones that I've made, I blended first. I don't know why. Maybe they just went too fast and I wasn't paying attention. That's my theory. But the better
That's interesting, because I made a fermented cranberry relish, and I used ginger and a combination of tangerines and mandarin oranges.
Yum. And ginger.
And some lemon.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, the cinnamon, I put some cloves and thyme. Thyme, thyme.
You did? Thyme in it?
Yeah. About a teaspoon of thyme. I did put... I have apple trees, so I did put a couple of small apples in there. But then I put in you're talking about ginger. I made a ginger bug. And so I had used that as my, I guess you could say, starter.
Starter.
Well, I mean, I think that would be great. I just can't do that.
But you can't do ginger. Yeah. But if it's a ginger,
I think that
but a ginger plug, well, you could use like a kefir or kefir if you want to keep it.
You could,
I've done it that way before with coconut water or just even a water kefir. Now I can't say kefir anymore, Steph.
Sorry, it's all messed up.
That's very cute. Now, going back to all this, you said.
But I did want to say, I did. Mine is chunky.
Yeah.
That's okay.
I've circled back around to that in my mind also, and what I realize is that if it's blended first, then it's all being exposed to oxygen, and if I can keep it underwater, then there's less of a chance again that those yeasts are going to grow because they kind of want. You know, the yeast and the air can colonize it if it's exposed. So even if it's in a jar.
You're saying don't blend it all real fine first. When you ferment it, roughly chop it. Is that what you're saying?
And then have enough water to cover. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Totally.
And then water to cover it.
Okay,
and then the orange zest, cinnamon, and the spices, did you both put that in before you fermented it?
I did.
Or after? Okay. So you didn't do anything, you didn't add anything after you fermented it except you blended it up?
Yeah, then I got to control the texture. Yeah, and if I had wanted to, I would have added a sweetener, but I feel like because I put that orange juice in there, I feel like it was just becoming sour enough for me to enjoy.
Yeah.
Okay.
I will admit, for my grandkids, I did put a little honey in there. It was low. No bees were.
You did it after fermenting.
Yeah. And I forgot to say, I do use salt.
Okay. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that gives us some ideas to play with. I don't know how my blood sugar is going to be. I'm hoping it would be good. Eat a lot of greens and green juice and all that with it and see if my blood sugar will be okay.
So the thing is...
just let it get as sour as you can.
Yeah.
Okay. I assume that. I'm glad you said that because I was sort of assuming that. Okay.
Yeah.
And my feeling, too, is this is a condiment. This isn't a side or a main, you know, it's like I just, you know, I make a little bit of it. I will admit sometimes I put it in a smoothie. Or, something like that.
Or like coconut yogurt or cashew
or
yogurt.
Or coconut yogurt or chia porridge.
Yeah, I was just going to say chia porridge, condiment, right.
It's a condiment. It's not meant to be a meal or, you know, it's something to flavor.
Right. Okay, I'll try and keep that in mind. Okay, that's great. Someday I will get to play with this.
Yes, you will.
Yeah, take pictures.
I will.
This is what happens.
I know, I barely do, but I have to fit it in because otherwise it's like I have withdrawal symptoms because I like to play with food. Somebody at Thanksgiving I didn't eat it, of course, but they made a cranberry pie, and I thought that was a pretty interesting thing. So we could do that and figure out a way maybe to eat it.
I
so
bet
that
it wasn't local.
I didn't even ask. I'm sure she had sugar and everything else in it, so I didn't ask. But I thought it was a blackberry pie because of the color, but she said, everybody said it was cranberry pie. And then, Steph, I want to tell you, today I have three tzatzikis I make now, and I like it better with cashew yogurt than coconut. But anyway, I made a third one today, and I got this recipe from
it was on a menu of a Mediterranean restaurant that we really like. And oh my God, this one came out really good. It had mint and sumac, and mm. it had the dill in it. It was really good.
Cool.
So
oh, mint. I love mint in a dip.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And have you ever had sumac?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. I don't know. It's cool. I make yours the most. Your recipe the very most. And I just love that. But now this one, cool. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Yeah. After the mint, you probably can't go back. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Unless I don't have any.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
I got a lot of things to play with someday.
That was fun.
I will post recipes when I do some of these new things. Because I got something else up my sleeve. I'm not telling what it is, but sounds good. I'll let you know if it comes out good. It'll be interesting. It'll be fun.
Cool.
All right.
You're welcome.
Okay, you can unmute me. If I do anything, I'll be hanging up, I'm sure.
Okay. All right. I will mute you now then.
All right. Great having you too. It's just lovely.
We're having Christmas. Okay. So I just noticed there was a question here from Lynn Rose. She says, Steph, is there a specific test you like to determine which gut bugs one needs to supplement?
It depends. Darn it.
Yeah.
It does depend. So it depends on how the person is feeling or what symptoms they're having in the gut. If there's any kind of stomach symptom, like gastric reflux or stomach pain or history of ulcers or family history of ulcers, I like to do the BioHealth 401H test.
Yeah.
It's also the most accurate for parasites outside of Viome. I am annoyed with Viome because they let my people down they've been out of commission for a little while, so I'm mad at them. That being said, I know that they are very accurate for everything except for H. pylori. So you'll get a nice test back that you find out, it cannot test for H. pylori. And I talked to the person who designed that test and who designed the doctor's data test. So I really have done a lot of thinking about this and which ones I want to use for
H. pylori. You really like them.
Yeah, I really like them, but if I suspect anything in the stomach or upper GI or esophagus, I go to the BioHealth 401H test. It is the most accurate. And if I miss H. pylori on someone, I feel like I'm doing a big disservice. So I'd rather get the less fancy test that has less little fun graphs, less instructions what to eat or not eat. But just more accuracy for that. The Viome test also, Doctor's Data is really good. So if a person's having I don't have any other word, just SIBO symptoms. I don't want to get a SIBO test because it doesn't give me actionable information. It just tells me there's enough bacteria that it's over the threshold that it shows up positive on a SIBO test. Doesn't tell me which bacteria. I go to the doctor's data test. The doctor's data test is going to tell me, give me a really good indication, albeit in the small and large intestine. But if it comes up high in E. coli or Enterococcus or Clostridium or any of those kind of bacteria, Klebsiella, that are commonly associated with SIBO, and the person's having SIBO symptoms, I feel like we have enough actionable information that we can actually do something about those specific bacteria and work to balance them out, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I find the Viome test is too much information. And same with the Ubiome test. which is far less accurate than the biome test, but is still way too much information. So then people just read it and it's like, okay, I have bacteria. Lots of bacteria. That's really nice. Yeah. But then, yeah, if not, it's a forest for the trees situation, then we don't know which ones are actually contributing to the environment being off in there. So what to balance.
And yeah. So then what do you think about the ones that do, like, the DNA, like the GI mapping and so forth?
Right, so that's what Viome does.
Okay, but do yeah. the other one do a better job, or okay?
Nope.
So for the benefit of people who are listening, do you want to share the yeah. difference between what they?
Yeah, it's the accuracy of their microscopes. It's the accuracy of their microscopes. So the Viome test, I can't remember if it was 20 times or 200 times more accurate. In terms of what they're able to see in there. And since what they're testing is not whether or not they can find a little bacteria, but they're testing for little pieces of the bacteria's DNA.
Right.
So it's really important for them to have good imaging. And, yeah, and so that's just what it is. So they just, for now, they have the most sensitive imaging. It's like a microscope sensitivity issue.
Okay.
Almost. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, someone else will come along. That's what I like about this, is that, like, you know, so that was their thing for a while, but now they're another test will come along and do better than them, I'm sure. And then they'll have to up to the next thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And I'm just looking here. So Lynn Rose, and you may have seen this, but Lynn Rose says in the series, I'm assuming she's talking about the interconnected series, there were a couple of practitioners that said that getting rid of H. pylori people are more prone to reflux.
Yes. Yes. So like H. pylori, okay, I would send someone for the test that's sensitive to H. pylori, the biohealth test, if they eat food and it sits in their stomach like a brick. Or they have, like, gastric reflux or GERD or, like, esophageal pain. Or if they keep losing their voice but they don't have a cold and it doesn't make sense. Or if they have, like, even a family history of ulcers or stomach issues. If they have, like, a iron deficiency that's unexplained and longstanding, those kind of things, then I suspect H. pylori.
What did you just say about losing your voice?
Yeah, so I had this with a few people, and I think I only know because of my choir conducting, because it doesn't happen a lot with clients because they just don't mention it or something. But people will say, like, oh, my voice has changed so much in the past year, and it's not necessarily an aging thing. You know, my voice has changed so much in the past year. I noticed, like, last summer I was going to sing on my birthday, and it couldn't. You know, it didn't sound like me. You know, this is weird. I don't have any other pain. So you can have a silent reflux that can affect your voice, your vocal cords. And it often goes undiagnosed. And so people will complain about their voice. And lo and behold, they go and get this H. pylori test, and they have it. And I feel grateful when I find it. I mean, it's they're associated with, what, like 95% of duodenal cancers and I don't like to.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I have a friend.
Yeah.
If you could send me something on that,
yeah.
I have a friend who's having that. Like, oh, she basically lost her voice, and even now she's got it back, but she has to be really careful with it. But she really won't listen to me unless there's like some. Her husband is a doctor, medical doctor.
Oh yeah.
And he is always making little jokes about me, and so because I guess you can do that, but if I actually had something scientific to show her, because it was like you said that and it like kind of hit me between the eyes, it's like oh
right,
but I need to have something specific, I can share with her. So
right.
You
yeah.
have something.
I mean, anyone who's, you can look up silent reflux, and see what you can find on there. But yeah, I'll send you something, Lynn. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That
cool.
makes so much sense.
Yeah, we always think, oh, I don't have an ulcer. It doesn't hurt. There can be a lot going on in the esophagus, but, like, we're not programmed to feel pain in there unless something is very wrong. We feel like every piece
yeah.
of food that we ate, we look so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. that would be really interesting. Yeah, I just put in Google silent reflex and losing voice, and you know, and something from the University of Pittsburgh comes up right away. You know, about all of this stuff. So is that
cool.
Jasper?
That's my dog. She's gonna go out for a pee.
Oh, that's
okay.
Your dog.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, good, because at first I was like, that can't be him. All right, let me double check and make sure if there's any other questions here. And I have no other hands up. Let's see. Really liked what you were sharing about the cranberries. You know, I'm just going to share this. So I'm doing, I'm fascinated by the moon and the planets. I am not an expert, but I've been reading a lot. And one of the things I'm discovering is that there are certain times during certain moon phases that there are certain foods to eat. So like those of you, that are doing it's not the second, I don't think she calls it Isabel's liver cleanse. You know, she kind of correlates it to the moon phases. And and so there are actually certain phases to eat things like cranberries. And so I'm not going to spill all of it because I'm writing a little series on my little blog post series on it. But there are, I was going to find some of my notes here. Like fermented foods, there are certain phases of the moon, and you may know this, that it's better to eat fermented foods. Let's see here. I do know during the wax, so this is for Sandy. Sandy, during the waxing moon, that's the best time to play with your food and try out new recipes. Yogurts are good during the waxing moon too. And warming type foods are good there. Full moon, that's when we feast. The waning moon, that's when you kind of clean out your cupboards, eat all the leftovers, and that's because during the moon, new moon is when you fast. And so that's just kind of the gist of it. But anyway, so I was going to see if I had cranberries in here. That would basically be during the waxing moon. So, anyway.
Cool.
Just throwing that in there.
Cool. So you're going to do a series on this?
That's my plan.
A series of calls? Cool.
And a series of just blog posts. Yeah.
Cool.
Well, and we have a full moon coming up, new moon coming up this weekend. So that's why that's why this weekend is a good time to do a fast or a liver cleanse or something like that. So right now we're supposed to be eating up all our leftovers.
Yeah. I'm running out.
And
good, I'm right on track. Great.
Yeah, waxing moon and cranberries, Mandy. Anyway, you know, it's just interesting to me. It's, they're all guidelines. You have to listen to yourself, as you say. Well,
I'm looking back at our questions, and now I understand a question that I did not understand before. And it's the thing that, it's the clarification that I really love to make. Can I make a clarification?
Please.
Lynn, thank you. There's been a lot of literature. There have been a few really popular books lately that have piggybacked on each other and have said that basically H. pylori fixes gastric reflux. So here's the thing. So if everything is, I know, it's so annoying, but so if everything is working correctly, your stomach can have a lot of acid and it's not going to go anywhere. It's going to stay in your stomach. You know, there's a sphincter that, that gets a chemical cue that says, like, oh, we got acid happening here. And it closes up so it doesn't ride up into the esophagus. So that's the first thing. And what can happen if we just have lower stomach acid, and it has nothing to do with H. pylori, if we have lower stomach acid, then that sphincter, that esophageal sphincter, may not be, like, too lackadaisical, and so letting the stomach acid ride up into the esophagus. And we often historically have associated that with having too much acid in the stomach, but it's actually a not enough acid in the stomach to get the chemical signal for everything to be working properly situation. And what H. pylori loves to do is have low stomach acid. They don't like stomach acid. So they'll move into your stomach and they'll actually create bicarbonate and make it even more alkaline in there, so they even further reduce the stomach acid. So if a person's having, let's say, like heartburn, and then they get H. pylori and the heartburn goes away, it's only because there's even less stomach acid. Which sounds really exciting, except that then you can't absorb your minerals or proteins. So ultimately, in order to gain full function of that system back and to work, you know, top down, and rebuild the digestive system, we need to have adequate stomach acid. And so H. pylori is not helping to do that. They always want to reduce the stomach acid. So I hope that helps. So it, symptomatically, it might seem like, oh, hey, they took the pain away. They must be good. But it's good to keep in mind that bugs are not good nor bad. But because we've labeled bugs as bad, it's a bit like a pushback where everyone's saying, well, look, all these parasites are good. These ones shut down your immune system so your arthritis gets better. Yay. This one shuts down your stomach, doesn't hurt anymore. Fantastic. Bacteria are the cure for everything, but they're not. It's just about getting them in the right balance. Yeah. Yeah. I hope that clarifies stuff, regarding that for you.
Well, you know, one thing, that I feel like you have been just always ahead of your time with all of this, because you were saying things 4 years ago when I met you that people are now starting to kind of put their toe in the water on. And one of those things is that
love it.
They're not the bad guys, you know, that kill. It's a war. You've been stating that for years. That's not what it is. And to embrace
it's not
and
that
understand
paradigm.
Them. Right. Yeah. And so that's what I've just always appreciated about your viewpoint on all of this.
Thanks, Lynn.
So
Yeah.
And they're talking about how stomachs can confuse, and it's like, well, that's only if you take what they say is the gospel, you know. It's like, okay, you listen to what they say, and somewhere in there is some truth for somebody, but it doesn't mean that it's your truth right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So just to keep on learning about each thing that is brought up in those summits so that you can eventually get the helicopter view and understand why they're saying that from their perspective. Because from everybody's perspective, they've got the truth. Yeah, and it can just be really good to just get more and more opinions and figure out for yourself what your priorities are and therefore your truth surrounding it. I find it hard in our allopathically based system, which we're breaking out of, to not be in a us versus nature mentality and to have that extend into the gut. but I think we're creating a new paradigm. We're creating a paradigm here that is different. But yeah, it's almost like we have to consciously continue to realign ourselves with that. We're not at war with our digestion or with the bacteria.
Right.
And that we can't label it that these ones are good and these ones are bad.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, I remember when I first heard you say that, it was like, oh, wow, man. That's just so cool. It's just, you know, because I've never heard anybody say that before. And it made me appreciate myself more. And I think right there, that is such a healing paradigm shift, that you don't have bad bacteria in you. You have bacteria. You have these bugs in you. They all, at some point in time, have a service that they do. And, you know, you just ask us to understand what that's all about.
Yeah, exactly. They will eat what we put in.
Yes, they will.
Bottom line. Yeah. One different output, we must different input.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, don't kill the garbage collector, Lynn.
Cute, Lynn.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Does anybody have any other questions? I don't see any other hands up. I'm gonna refresh for questions. Nope. All right. Well, I have really so enjoyed and appreciated having you here. Is there anything that you would like to share before we leave?
No, just have a good December. Happy holidays. Everybody here who has a holiday this month, and otherwise, stay well in winter.
Yeah. Well, Hanukkah started last Sunday. So happy Hanukkah. We've got Christmas coming up at the end. Kwanzaa comes right after that, and then the New Year. So, you know, really just celebrate, appreciate all the miracles that happen every day. And I know Dr. Rita Marie sends her love and blessings to everybody.
Yeah.
So. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well.
Bye.
Oh, I know I'm not very good at this. Let's see. I don't know how she does this. Let's see. I'll guess there you go. Oh, here we go. We have a party.
It is. It's
going to
be
weird. Yep.
All right.
Everybody.
Night. Night.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.